According to a Zagat survey, 44% of couples plan to celebrate Valentine's Day by dining out this year. But whether you're going to spend an evening with a special menu at a restaurant or a part of the 56% who are eating at home, you want to hear about what Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg have to say about picking the perfect mate for your food. They have written two James Beard Award-winning books, What to Drink with What You Eat and The Flavor Bible, and their latest, The Food Lover's Guide to Wine, includes hundreds of profiles on wines, tasting tips, and suggestions for what to drink when you're on a budget. It's published by Little Brown, and I'm pleased it has brought Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg back to our show today. Hello.
We're always delighted to be back. Thank you.
It seems to me that most of the foods that we associate with Valentine's Day, especially the desserts, are loaded with calories. What about wines? Do they also make us fat? And how do they compare to other drinks like beer or soft drinks?
Sure. Well, you know, if you compare the numbers, I mean, a glass of whole milk is 160 calories, a full cup of whole milk, whereas a glass of wine is just 120 calories. So some of the sweeter wines, you know, they're a little richer and a little bit more going on calorically. But I think if you look at the studies, the U.S. Dietary Guidelines for Americans recommends wine as part of a healthy diet.
And on Valentine's Day, a lot of people drink bubbly wines.
Absolutely.
Are they also low in sugar?
Actually, they're more low in alcohol. So again, if you're going to get your calories from alcohol, champagne is like 12.5%, whereas a big red wine might be 14 or 16%. So if you go with a lighter style wine, like a Gewürztraminer or a Riesling, again, even lower alcohol levels, lower calories. So if you want to drink a lot, just drink a lighter wine.
You begin with Michael Pollan's rule, drink wine with food, not too much. Don't most wine lovers prefer to drink their wine with food?
Well, I think that that's really what it's all about. I mean, that's the tradition, is that wine and food came up together. But I think it's more of a European tradition than it is in the United States. And it's sort of odd that, you know, in the U.S., we're just kind of coming into our own as wine drinkers. You know, for the first time last year, the United States is now the largest consumer of wine in the world, and yet the per capita consumption is relatively low.
Well, so
we have a very big population. So I think we're just kind of coming into our own in terms of figuring out how do we drink it. And so I think historically in the U.S., we've had it much more in cocktail parties, wine and cheeses, that kind of thing, and not something that's been a regular accompaniment to the evening meal, although we're hoping that that's something that's going to change because we think that wine is something that can really enhance everything you eat, from pizza to filet mignon.
For years, I thought that wine was really awful stuff because I only had it at gallery openings.
And you got the stuff that the artists could afford to provide.
In a plastic cup, I'm going to assume also, right?
You point out that even though California has been producing wine on and off for 200 years, France has been producing it for 2,000 years, and I imagine Italy for about that long.
Exactly.
But California wines have been doing fairly well in recent blind tastings. They compare favorably these days?
Oh, I think California wines have been doing great for a long time. Actually, just American wines in general were winning awards at World's Fairs in the late 1800s. So wine is not brand new, and it doesn't just take place in California. It's produced in every state in the U.S., and I think a lot of, you know, there's the great Judgment of Paris, which was the blind tasting where American wines did so well, especially Chateau Montelain and all. But I think what we really wanted to celebrate was America's wine history. It's not a brand new beverage that just appeared at Trader Joe's last week. It's been around for a long time, grown all over. It started in Virginia, so we have a good, rich history of delicious wines.
King James demanded that the colonists in Jamestown grow grapevines by law in 1619.
Absolutely.
I've had some more recent wines from Virginia. It may not be the best place to grow some grapes. I guess I would only drink it if somebody said by law that I had to.
But there are
6,200 wineries all over the United States.
No, we love Virginia wines, actually. We've gotten to taste some great Virginia wines, you know, Linden.
Barbersville.
And,
Barbersville makes some of the best
Octagon
red wine.
Is one of the great Bordeaux-style reds. We absolutely love it. No, we have to give Virginia wines their own. In fact,
drank the wrong one.
Were you at a gallery opening?
No, and even the Kluge Estate, which Donald Trump, I think, just bought and is taking over, we love their sparkling wines. We think they're incredibly impressive, so we hope he's going to bring some new life to that. Some really good wines in Virginia. And across the U.S., there are wines being made in all 50 states at this point in time for the last 10 years.
It's important to find the right kind of soil to grow those grapes in.
Absolutely.
That's the trick.
Yes. And back in the days of Thomas Jefferson, when he was, you know, a real patriot trying to get wine made in the United States, because, of course, he was such a fan of wine, bringing it over from France and helping to stock the White House cellars, as well as his own, of course. he really worked on trying to nurture a winemaking industry in Virginia, which unfortunately wasn't successful back then.
So were we making really world-class wines before Prohibition changed everything?
Oh, yeah. If you look back to the story of the Norton grape, there's a great book out there called The Wild Vine about the history of the Norton grape, and Todd Kleiman did a great job with that. You can read the story of that particular grape, how it went on to be named the best red wine in the world. I mean, this is centuries ago.
Mm-hmm. And then Prohibition came along. Historians have said that Prohibition killed America's taste for stronger beers as well, and that's why Budweiser has become so popular. Or even weaker Coors Light.
Yeah, I think Prohibition didn't help anyone. I think also what it did is it also made people want to drink very strong drinks. Like a traditional martini used to be 50-50, but during Prohibition, well, they're not going to dilute that hard alcohol with some, you know, lighter vermouth. So that's how we become to have this, the dry martinis, because of Prohibition.
Now, wine does intimidate many Americans. I guess one of the explanations I came up with is that a kid in Europe grows up with wine on the table, and so is being taught even through osmosis. In this country, most adults have to learn about it themselves, unless they come out of some ethnic background.
Exactly. Now, I think wine is just a grocery in Europe, whereas in the United States, it's this other thing, this thing that's, you know, for many years, if you think back to the snooty sommeliers of the 1960s and the 1970s and those fancy French restaurants, they'd look down their noses if you mispronounced a wine. Well, you know, wine is one of the most complicated things there is. I mean, we write books about food, but we also writing about wine, you have to master geography. You have to master foreign languages. The average American still does not speak a foreign language. So when you're looking at taking on a wine label from Germany or Spain or one of those another country where you've got some foreign terminology, I think it can turn a lot of people off.
And then there are all those problems with dates and stuff. My guests are Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg. Their latest book, The Food Lover's Guide to Wine, published by Little Brown and Company. And there are those problems of dates, and people have these vintage charts that they bring with themselves, they bring to restaurants. Is that the way to choose a wine?
I think you're getting into collector's territory with dates, you know, for people who thought, oh, well, this is the one date I have to drink. But, you know, Aldo Somme, who was named the best sommelier in the world, and he's at Le Bernardin, he gave us some really good advice. He said, you know, the vintage charts, you're crazy if you follow them religiously, because what happens is I've got some great wines on my list of different vintages. It might have been a great vintage, but if it's four times the price of something that was still a very respectable vintage that's selling for, you know, a quarter of the price and is drinking better right now. I mean, the other thing, the complicated thing about vintage is you have to know when to drink it. It's not just, okay, 2005, great vintage, Burgundy, Bordeaux, you want to drink it. But it reaches its peak at a different time, and you have to know when that peak is.
And I once read that Malcolm Forbes used to give guests to his home a wine that was made in the year of their birth. And then they take it home, and invariably the wine was way over the hill, or it hadn't been stored perfectly. So there were other factors there.
Well, we had an instance like that last night. We opened up a 2004 Chateau Montelena Chardonnay.
Which one of you was born in 2004?
Oh, well, not a birth year wine, but a wine that, you know, we opened it up and we thought, oh, goodness, you know, how is it? It took some time to really reach its peak. And I think that's especially true of an older wine. I mean, this was only 8 years old, but if you're looking at something that's, you know, twice that age or longer, it's easy to miss the peak. So I think that's the problem with collectors. A lot of amateurs try to get involved in collecting, but you can really miss it if you're not really staying on top of how a wine is drinking and understanding that process.
And tomorrow's Valentine's Day, so crack that bottle that you've been saving. What are you waiting for? It's Valentine's Day. Crack the good one tomorrow.
If you have a good one, there's a section in your book where a few master sommeliers give people tips on how to break out of their comfort zones when it comes to trying new wines. For someone who's always ordering a Merlot for the red and a Chardonnay for the white, what would you suggest that they try to diversify?
Well, I think for a Chardonnay lover, and I am a Chardonnay lover, I'm from California, from the Bay Area, and I cut my teeth on Chardonnay. If I was going to branch out, I would do a Viognier from France. They're incredibly light, delicate, with a lot of flowery notes to them, like peaches. And I think the Chardonnay lover is going to find a lot in common with it. It's just going to be a lighter, more delicate style, but I think they're really going to love it. And I remember the first one I had was at Picholine restaurant, Terrence Brennan. We went in for Karen's favorite dish. It was white gazpacho, and we asked for a wine recommendation, and I thought, you know, he said Viognier, I was thinking Viognier, and it turned out to be just an incredible bottle of wine, and it's really one of my favorite whites now.
I think in terms of some of the reds, you know, if you're a Merlot fan, take a look at some of those Malbecs coming out of Argentina that are still offering some amazing values. I think that's a good place to go. And still in Spain, I mean, the prices have gone up because people have been discovering them, but the Ribera del Duero's have that wonderful characteristic that's not going to be overwhelming or underwhelming to a Merlot lover. Something to keep an eye out for.
Well, the big problem is also price, isn't it? A lot of people don't want to spend more than $8 to $10 for a bottle of wine. That's still, if you do drinking wine regularly, that can get rather expensive over the course of a month.
And we have no problem with that. We have a chart in the book with 150 wines under $15. And so,
and I think half of them are probably under $10.
We'd rather see you drinking wine than avoiding it for the price, because there's just a lot of great stuff out there.
I think people, you know, are intimidated by things like, you know, they think boxed wine, it's so déclassé. Well, in fact, it's that green, that very environmentally friendly packaging, I think, is offering a lot of great new values in wine. I think Daniel Ballou was ahead of his time with his Detour wine that he started with Daniel Jonas several years back, where he was doing a bag in box. And I kind of, you know, snubbed my nose up at it before I tasted it, but it was unbelievable.
But they're not making that
they're
anymore.
They're not making it anymore, unfortunately. But there are others who are using that packaging technology, and so definitely don't dismiss those.
And it's interesting that Europeans are buying box wines.
Because yes. They
are the standard for Americans, aren't they?
Well, I think the Italians had that history of taking their containers to the winemaker and having them filled. So they're already into alternative packaging to just going out and buying a case of bottles and bringing it home. So I think that they were really already open to that.
You have 10 suggestions for getting more pleasure out of wines, and one is to store it well. Mm-hmm. But most New Yorkers, people don't have wine cellars, that's for sure. A lot of them don't have a wine refrigerator. So how's the best way to store a bottle?
Well, I think a couple quick tips is don't store your wine next to your radiator or above your stove. So try to find sort of the most neutral place in your apartment. Actually, for the longest time, our most neutral place was right by the front door. We had a little spot there, and it really held wines beautifully. But I think that's one way to do it. Just avoid the heat.
And I think also you want to make sure that you store them on their side. So you don't we want to keep them standing up if you're planning to keep them for a while, because the cork will dry out, oxygen will get in, and your wine will spoil. So you want to make sure you can keep it on your side, if at all possible.
Now, good quality glassware is another important factor. What difference does the glass make? Do I have to spend a fortune on Riedel glasses if I want to enjoy wine fully? They're almost guaranteed to break a lot sooner than the cheap ones.
Well, the Riedel Ovation line, that's the $10 glassware that you can get at Target and some other places, it really offers a lot of quality. You've got, you know, centuries of wine glass making expertise put into the glass, and those work really well. Those are kind of our casual glasses, but we have invested in Zalto glasses, which are a staggering, I hate to say it, $65 a glass. But I'll tell you, we've had them for
years. Don't put
years.
It in the dishwasher.
We've had them.
Actually,
you can put them
it.
In the dishwasher. They are the most delicate-looking glass, but boy, are they sturdy. We've had them for years. We've only broken one recently. I think when we use them almost every day, you get a lot of cost per wear for that price.
In Italy, wine is often served in short, narrow, 6-ounce glasses. Would the wine have tasted better at that restaurant if it had been served in a big bowl?
I would have asked for a different glass.
It's why we bring our own glasses to Chinese restaurants. When we do a BYO Chinese restaurant, like if we're going up for Peking duck or something, and it's a casual restaurant, we'll...
You bring your own bottle and your own glasses?
Absolutely.
Bring our own, because, you know, you don't want to be drinking out of those thick-lipped glasses. Sometimes we get etched glasses that you can't even see through, and that's a little tough. So.
And what would you drink with Chinese food?
I think if it's Peking duck, it's going to be a nice bottle of Pinot.
And, well, you know, it's hard to make generalizations because mm-hmm. China is such a complex, you know, mm-hmm. country. You've got
every
different
dish is
cuisines.
Different.
But
right.
Gewürztraminer with spicy dishes always does it for me.
I like Rieslings with my Chinese food.
Oh, Riesling, of course.
A good day.
That's my standard go-to.
Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg will be speaking at the 92nd Street Y on Thursday, March 1st at 6:30. And there'll be wine and hors d'oeuvres there. For ticket information, go to our show page at WNYC.org. Their latest book, The Food Lover's Guide to Wine, it is published by Little Brown. Thank you so much for being
Thanks
with us.
Thanks so much again. For having us, Leonard.